Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This is a Lip Media podcast.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we are recording. We pay our respect to elders past and present and the Aboriginal elders of other communities who may be listening today.
Welcome to The Gays Are Revolting, a dissection of social and cultural issues relevant to gay men.
We put the G in LGBTQIA+, and we're here to help you be the best G you can be.
Follow us on Instagram or Twitter, or join our community on Facebook by searching The Gays Are Revolting.
And support the show and access our after shows and live streams at patreon.com/gaysrevoltingpod. Hey!
Hello! good. We have a bit of a special episode.
We have a very special episode tonight. Of course, a while ago we did a mums episode where Mikey and I had our mums in the studio. Unfortunately, your mum and Luke's mum couldn't do it. Luke's mum lives in Adelaide and your mum was living overseas, but your mum's just moved back.
So, lo and behold, here she is, along with my gay brother, Ty. Hi, guys.
I'm very excited because we're going to have a big chat with you guys. It's obviously a very interesting dynamic and very unique for a lot of gay people. A lot of us don't have gay siblings, so I'm really interested to hear how you... I mean, I've hung out with you guys drunk, interested to hear in an interview scenario. In an interview scenario, what that's like. And also for a mother to have two gay sons. I cannot wait to get into that.
#blast.
We also have a great interview coming up with William Trulin, founder and CEO of Black, an organization working towards strengthening visibility for Indigenous members of the LGBT plus community.
Very important interview, especially with everything that's going on, and excited to get into that. But before we do, in the studio this week, it is just Kyle and I, so we are going to get stuck into your family.
Oh, God. I'm so scared.
For those listening, mum's name is Patrizia, and your brother's name is Ty. Hello, Patrizia. Hello, Ty.
Hi.
You both listen to the podcast?
Yes.
Every single week.
Even when I tell her not to, I'm like, Mum, maybe just sit this one out. She's like, all right. And then she's like, sorry, listen to your podcast. I have some questions. I'm like, hell.
Yeah, you're the reason that trying to drag sex stories out of him.
It's the most infuriating thing that I literally can't stop her from listening to.
I love that Ty's just sitting in the corner going, wrong brother. Yes, we should have had you on earlier to tell some of your sex stories. I know there's quite a few
sex stories.
So, Patrizia, you've just moved back to Australia after various stints overseas. Tell us where you've been living and what brought you back to Melbourne.
Well, I had planned to come back to Melbourne. My boys are here. They're my life. So I had to come back. Basically, was based in England, but all over. And I was doing care work or companionship work to fund some travel. So it was a bit of travel, a bit of work, a bit of travel, a bit of work. Yeah,
pretty good lifestyle.
And so just to go back even further, Kyle, you were born in South Africa.
Yeah.
But Ty, were you born in South Africa as well? Okay, so you both sort of grew up.
So yeah, we grew up in South Africa and then we moved to Australia in 2006, the three of us. And then in recent times, Mum moved to the UK to do some traveling and working.
I sort of got into a sort of a situation where I was a bit of a burnout after the boys moved out with work and all that. And I just got this 3 o'clock in the morning thought.
Yeah.
Next thing the boys said, go for it.
And that's when you went to the UK?
For a year. Yeah. And it ended up being 5 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But I think it was so good for you because you traveled so much. And I think it was like a lot of soul searching and stuff like that as well.
Which is important to do.
Yeah.
And it was great because, I mean, Ty also used to come out because of his work. So I used to see him at least once a year or twice a year.
Usually twice, yeah.
And were you based in London?
No, I worked all over England, okay, even Scotland.
Oh, so wow. You'd be like, yeah, staying with families and stuff.
I'd be staying with families, or else, you know, it wasn't worth having a place. I'd rather go on holiday somewhere. Amazing. With the money.
Yeah, you're doing what your kids should be doing. When they stay.
Yeah, she has the photo albums to, like,
I've done
prove
lots of
it.
Travel.
Who knows when we'll be traveling again? Which brings me to my question: like, you literally decided to move back and the world went to shit and you came back the worst possible time, yeah, during a global pandemic. What was it like moving back to?
Because you were you got here just after the hotel enforced quarantine.
Like, yeah, just started. Yeah,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. Maybe you were one of the first people I knew to
few
do that.
Days.
How was that?
Horrible.
Yeah.
Imagine hearing about it every day.
Yeah.
Well, I've got you on Facebook. I was enjoying your Facebook.
How was
updates.
The food, Mum?
They're so nice to me, aren't they?
We're your boys. We have the right.
The food was disgusting. You know, I mean, it's bad enough, like, you closed in these four walls, no fresh air.
Yeah, I couldn't believe there was no balconies or anything.
No balconies. You can't open a window. Mm. I suffer already from a little bit of anxiety. Mm-hmm. And with this whole corona thing, I was even more anxious. Mm. I'd given up smoking.
Yeah, that would have been a big thing with no windows.
Right? So it was just like, I had to be very strong mentally. Yeah.
Have you stuck with the no smoking?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah,
I quit
so
smoking as well because I was not as enforced as you, but because I was at home and wasn't going out.
It wasn't
out
about being enforced. I had planned that I was going to give up smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, corona and also coming back to Oz,
so
because of the expense.
Yeah.
And just sort of
good timing.
Yeah, I just sort of
in the worst possible way.
Yeah,
yeah.
Best time to do it.
So it's been 5 years since you've been living in the same city as Mum. What's it like having Mum back in the city, boys?
Yeah.
Well, last time we lived together was all in Brisbane. So
yes,
like
true.
This is a completely new environment for Mum.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's been a bit of a difficult time to move back as well.
Yeah.
So we've been spending a lot of time together, a bit of catch up. Also, I guess because I saw her semi-regularly, like every 6 months while she was overseas, whereas Kyle saw her twice in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we've been spending a lot of time together.
Yeah, they're indulging me, they're coming over, we're going for nice long walks.
Yes.
For walks or brunch. Or
I've seen you've done a few brunches.
Or I do the mothery thing and I make them something to eat.
Oh, cute.
And
I brought Duncan and stuff over a few times.
Yeah, Duncan's come over. Yeah.
Mum's a great cook, so, like, we're not complaining.
Wonderful.
She uses that as a bribery to get us over. And, yeah, we're totally fine with that.
Yeah, because it's a bit lonely because, I have to, like, reestablish myself here.
Yeah.
I don't have friends.
Yes, of course.
I mean, I was born in Melbourne.
Yeah.
But I really hardly ever lived here. I left when I was 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we moved back, I went to Brisbane because of the climate.
Mm-hmm.
And the boys did uni there and all that. Although we did do a trip together for my birthday.
Yeah, we came to Melbourne together.
The three of us.
Mm. I kind of always thought we'd end up in Melbourne, and now we have. Because Ty and I always really loved it, and we'd come here for long weekends.
So I'm so thrilled that they are in Melbourne. Mm. When I had to come back, it was Melbourne.
isn't it wonderful that they live in the same city as well? Because imagine if you had them in different cities, you'd have to be traveling between the
two. Yeah, Mum, who would you pick?
Oh, boy.
Well, speaking of that... As I was saying, it is an unusual dynamic to have two gay sons.
Yeah.
It's not, I mean, you know, they're obviously, it's not unheard of, but for a lot of people, that is quite a unique experience. What is it like? Like, what is the experience for you to have two queer children?
It's just normal.
It's your normal.
It's my normal. I mean, I don't know. I've never really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I
adore
reality.
Them so much. And I mean, I think they're just such superb human beings. They made mothering so easy for me.
So easy?
Mostly.
Yeah.
What was the coming out process like from your perspective?
Well, Carl was the surprise.
Right, yeah.
For all of us.
Carl was the surprise. So it was a little bit more of a shock.
Yeah. How old was Ty?
I was 20.
Oh,
okay. 20.
Yeah, I was 20. Yeah.
But I knew.
Mm. I don't know how.
I mean, like, when we actually had that conversation, I was 20, and it wasn't because I chose to. A situation kind of occurred where I was forced to have that conversation
because
the question was being asked. Whereas, I mean, it was fine. It went down fine. There were a few tears and that kind of thing. But, like, it was never an issue, I guess. Because of, like,
I did ask him in high school and he denied it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I wasn't 20 was when I felt comfortable telling people.
Yeah.
I'd told probably my friends. I mean, I guess moving here from a different country, I got to reestablish who I was.
Yeah, very true.
So I kind of had 6 months to figure out who I was before I kind of told you. Mm-hmm. I started uni here. It took me a while to tell the friends, but I mean, I went to an all-boys boarding school where it just really wasn't an option.
Yeah.
So there was always a part of my life that I kind of just put on the back burner, like I'll work that out later. Mm-hmm. I really hadn't had much even experience with boys until I was 19. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like I was hiding it. It was just like delayed.
It wasn't, weren't at that point yet.
Yeah. So,
and then how long was it between that and then Kyle?
I think I was around 19 or 20.
No,
I think
you were younger. You had that when I started having the wobbles was when you were in high school and you had the 35-year-old after. Yeah. Tee-hee. And that's when I had a backflip. And yeah, it wasn't about the gayness, it was about age difference. Someone.
That's what was exciting.
For you, yeah, perhaps.
I think maybe what was exciting.
So, I thought you'd tell me this story in your version of the story. Your mum didn't know about this. Is this?
Yeah, I didn't really know what she knew. I don't think she knew a lot.
Well, it sounds like she did. Yeah. Let's crack this open. No.
She definitely knew
Mums
some of it.
Mums aren't stupid. They know what's going on.
I knew a lot of it because I made a big stink about it.
Yeah.
Italian bloods.
It's very fiery.
So that's when you sort of had a bit of an inkling, but then when you decided to come out.
Yeah, but then he brought a girl home. Yeah, right. Also from high school.
Oh, yeah, I did. So I was kind of a late bloomer, I would say, in regards to Australian culture, because I feel like so many Australian people, they've all like had their first kiss at like 13 years old and had sex like 15. It's like I had my first kiss with a girl in year 12. Like,
maybe you're just ugly. Don't blame Australian culture.
I was. Well, I was a weird looking teenager.
She'd stalking him.
But. Yeah, so I had a girlfriend for like a month or two and she was very
always
aggressive.
At the front door and he was full of blood bites.
And yeah, she wanted a piece of me.
Yeah. So I used to say, door open.
Were you secretly like thrilled that a girl was in the house?
No, actually I didn't. I was just acting like a normal
I remember dating her and being like, yes, I have a girl. Like, this is the end of all those gay thoughts. I might have a chance here.
When you think back on it now, when you think of kids forcing themselves to go through stuff like that. And then it also sort of raises the interesting point that it must be really hard for people who are bisexual, who do have that genuine attraction to both men and women, that there is an assumption made if they do have a boyfriend or if they do bring boys home,
that they must
be gay. And then if they bring girls home, it's a cover or vice versa.
I remember during when I dated her, I remember being into it. It wasn't like I was like, oh, this is literally just like a cover. Mm. But I do remember feeling the kind of relief being like, oh, great. Like maybe I am saved from this.
Mm. So your first signs with
I was just going to say it's like a conversation we had recently because I had a story on my Instagram of me making out with a girl and Mum was like, I don't understand.
Yeah.
I feel like that's such a weird early 2000s thing to post on social media.
I was drunk. Girls.
You're trash.
Yeah, but he's really sucking her face. There,
oh, God.
I made out for like a long time.
Please
I don't know what to tell
her. I've seen Ty's Instagram. I don't know if you should be following that, to be honest.
No, Mum is the momager of this Kardashian family. She is the one in Italy being like, yeah, pose in your Speedo, take that, like, get that shot. And I'm just like cringing in the background.
Oh, no, no.
She's my own personal Christiana.
So you really signs with Kyle with a 35-year-old, and then with Ty, you said in high school. So Ty would have been the first one that you sort of had signs with. Did you have any friends that you could talk to about it? Did you have a lot of gay friends?
Well, look, from the age of 17, I basically lived in gay clubs.
Right, okay.
To me, it wasn't like, I don't know. It was just like normality. Like all my gay friends that I did have, I was from an art school. I was always a little bit eclectic, a little bit different anyway. I never sort of fitted in with the normal crowd. I liked to dress a little bit different. I was arty. I came from a divorced family. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was like just normal for me, you know. They were my friends, so I didn't think, oh, you're gay or you're this. Mm. I just saw them as normal, you know, people.
So there was no real fear for you when you were asking Ty when he was in high school?
Look, I mean, I had the chat with him. Mm. You know, I just had a chat about promiscuity and this and that. And so it was basically just covering the grounds. And
giving the information if he was sure.
And then I sort of stepped back because I realized their friends and who they were mixing with. And I just thought, you know what? you'll be fine.
Mum gave me like the, I'm just worried about how people will treat you, that you're making your life harder, that kind of thing. And I think obviously like I was the first one, so that those were the concerns because like she was protective.
I was like also very concerned when he started to go clubbing. I said, when you go outside the club, always be in a group, you know, always please, you know, just the thought of someone just, you know, hitting him. I mean, even the thought of it now is just like, ugh.
I mean, well, don't worry, I'm around usually, so it's fine. I'll keep him safe.
So it was more in that sort of respect and just keep safe and just... watch who you hang out with and things like that. Because it's different, you know, like when you're young and or your friends or when you go out, and it's different when your own children are gay. You know, you become even more protective. And so, you know, anything that might, you know, make them feel different or someone who will attack them or anything like that, then the tiger comes out.
Of course, yeah. You know, I mean, having had experience on the gay scene, you'd also be aware that there is obviously a prevalence of drugs on the gay scene.
Exactly.
Is that another conversation thing that you had?
Yeah.
Poppers. Good, healthy. Yeah, it's healthy.
Definitely.
We had this conversation about
we were having a walk.
We
were having a walk in the park, and Mum's like, oh, the place where I'm staying, like the hallway smells. I'm like, oh, what? And she's like, yeah, it smells like poppers. And I was like, just so that we're on the same page, like, what do you think poppers is? And she's like, you know, like the stuff you smell in clubs. And I was like, okay, so the same poppers as me.
If she was going to gay clubs in the 80s, then she knows what poppers smells like.
Full of poppers.
Full of poppers.
It's never smelled it.
Never. I couldn't handle it. Because I didn't really do drugs.
Neither.
Like, I was just always on a natural high, so I never really drank or did the drugs.
I have the memory of when I came out, and it was kind of... like you dragged it out of me. And I remember specifically because you're watching Desperate Housewives and there was a specific scene when the redhead Brie or whatever her name was, the sun came out and she's like, well, no one ever tells me anything. So are you gay or are you not? And then I just felt like a breath, like a breath on the back of my neck as I was on the computer on MSN at the time. And she's like, so that guy, Luke, he's not Ella's friend, is he? I was like, I don't know. And you were like, just tell me, no one ever tells me anything. So I was like, no. And
she was like, specifics.
Yeah, I do. And you were like, he's not Ella's boyfriend, is he? And I was like, no. And then you were like, is he your boyfriend? And I just remember shrugging my shoulders and you're like, just tell me. And then I think I just silently nodded and you're like, that's okay, that's fine, I just wanted to know. And then you went and cried. I remember you sat on the stairs. I think you went to your bedroom and closed the door and you called your friend Marie, who had a gay son.
Who's part of my coming out story.
Yeah. And I remember sitting on the stairs and trying to eavesdrop your conversation, but I never really heard anything. Yeah. So I'm curious as to like what kind of advice she gave you.
She didn't give me advice. It was more like because of this 35-year-old, it all started from that. And you were like a closed book. You were like a totally different person. You weren't open with me. You were defensive. I felt like I'd lost you. But at the same time, I was being protective. So like you wouldn't get me, you know, to change my mind about the 35-year-old or whatever.
Angry mama
And like I knew, and then I'm being grilled and I'm like trying not to.
And I'm telling him that like when he goes to the clubs to tell him to stay away from you, because if I catch him, he's going to be in problems and I don't care if I'll go to jail for it. You know, so it was like
I did that.
Heavy.
I made him feel very small at the clubs, if that makes you feel any better.
Great, thank you.
But I think so many people.
So it was that, that was the whole era of it. So obviously now he finally, you know, and you know, I mean, Luke was a nice guy, you know, so it was fine. But it was just that whole like, okay, now I've got two gay sons.
It was such relief at the time because so many people have the preconception that I have a gay brother, therefore it must be so much easier for me to come out. But I feel like it's actually the complete opposite.
No, I felt like
there was so much more pressure on me, like in my mind, like for parents to like continue the family, like bloodline or something, or like have kids. Not that we can't have kids, but it's just there was more pressure on me to be straight. So I think, a lot of people have a misconstrued idea.
I also think 15 years ago, that was a much bigger concept, the idea.
Have a few tears in selfishness for myself, because, I mean, they are two beautiful specimens, not to have a grandchild from them. There were a few tears for myself.
Just trying a breeding program.
Yeah. You know, so it was just a little bit of selfishness thinking, I'm not going to have grandchildren. But, I mean, it's possible.
I remember, the first thing I said was, please don't blame me. It's not my fault.
Oh, yes. He says, it's got nothing to do with me.
And is that something you talk to the boys about now? I mean, we've had a lot of conversations since they've come out about, obviously, marriage equality and that sort of thing. And it is something we see a lot more in mainstream media. We are seeing queer families and stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, is that a conversation you still have with the boys?
I don't think it's anything we've spoken about recently.
No, but I mean, I have spoken about time, about children, or maybe in the future when they find the right person. Carl's found the right person. So,
speaking of Carl finding the right person, I've spent a lot of time with Duncan and I absolutely adore him. I think he's such a sweet, lovely country boy.
When he met Carl in the beginning and I asked Ty, and Ty had like so many good things to say. And whatever Ty says is good.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, he doesn't approve that easily of anybody. Mm-hmm. So he's pretty special.
Look, I got
it right.
He
must be pretty special. So, well, yeah. And I've met him now. He is.
Yeah, I was going to say, you just met him for the first time, really. Mm-hmm. You obviously approve.
And I just love seeing them together. Yeah. They're like really, really good together. Yeah. You know, they really compliment one another.
It's such a weird thing dating someone for so long and them only meeting a parent now after like two plus years.
And the thing is, I can just see the easiness and how he's himself. There's no pretentiousness. There's free flowing, the way they look at each other. Just the way it's very easy to see. You know,
the way I roll my eyes at him.
Look, our bedrooms are next to each other and they giggle like schoolgirls at 1 in the morning. You can just tell.
Oh, they're not giggling, sweetie.
No. That's giggling. They're just so happy to be in each other's company and all the time.
No, you're right. Yeah. Oh, stop.
Now, listen, Patrizia, we've been grilling you a little bit so far and we've been letting Ty get off easy. So, Ty, I've got a few questions for you as well. Kyle, do you want to start?
No, I was just going to say we've been living together for, like close to a decade. Like ever since like I moved out when I was like 18 or something, we've been living.
It is because I moved out when I was 21, literally the week after, and then you moved in a year later. So it's been 10 years.
Like,
wow.
That's other people move out of home, but I've always kind of had a bit of home with me while living out of home. COVID-19's really thrown things out of the works, but I've been having talks with Duncan, which you know, about moving in with him and like progressing our relationship in that way in the near-ish future. But there hasn't really been any talks for lately because I don't really know what's happening. But when that happens, how do you think it'll go like with us? Like, are you worried or?
No, because I mean, we've talked about this a lot and I mean, it's sad because like I love living with you and we're so close and you take for granted being able to see the person that is like the world to you like every single day. But to me, it makes me happy because you get to then, you know, like take that next step in your relationship and like that's what I would want for you. Kyle actually lived with me and my partner. We were together for 7 years.
Took a step into the next relationship with Kyle.
And I was like, well, this is going well, but Kyle's coming with. So like he lived with me and my boyfriend for like about four years.
We moved from Brisbane together.
We all moved here together. So Kyle's kind of like my child, really. So I'm probably going to have like empty nest syndrome. Or
and you'll sympathize.
Ty might adopt a child now.
Yeah.
You might sympathize with me.
Yeah, it'll be a really odd transition.
It is a beautiful relationship that you guys have as brothers. I mean, I'm close with my brothers as in that I love them, but our lives could not be more different. I've got one who's a tradie and one who's a scientist. Yeah.
I guess I've always felt really lucky to have a gay brother because I feel like that's really kind of bonded us and we are so close and we know everything about each other's lives. We have all the same friendship groups. Mm. It's really nice to have like a best friend in a relative. Yeah.
Is that how you would describe?
When you were teenagers, you were like chalk and cheese.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, so but you are, I mean, your personalities are different, but you have a very strong bond, I guess is what I'm saying. Yeah. How would you describe your relationship?
Well, like, I think you're right that Kyle and I are very different personality wise. And I think in our teens, we had a lot of, I don't know, I wouldn't say issues, but like we didn't always relate. But I think shared experience and like love, we've been able to put a lot of that aside. Mm. And I think like I've always felt like our whole life that like Kyle's very hard-headed. He doesn't want to hear when he's wrong or anything like that. But I feel like I've always been that person that can just sit him down and be like, hey, you're being an idiot or you're being a dick or you need to rein yourself in. Mm-hmm. And I always feel like he won't take that from anyone else.
No, he won't. Not from me. I have to go to Tyra and say, please speak to your
brother.
Tyra's
always been the mediator.
We've had an argument, Tyra and myself.
Yeah.
Carl is the one that just can't deal with it. You know, he just...
Yeah, I guess in a way, because for most of my life, it has always been the three of us. We've never really had a big family. We've never, like, had close relationships with, like, a lot of our family. So it's always been, we've been a tight-knit trio.
Yeah.
Dad's been in my life, but he's always lived far away. Yes. And he's, like, because, like, now he lives in South Africa. He's always lived in, like, another state and stuff like that. So I have a lot more contact with mum. And, yeah, Ty, I guess, has always been, like, kind of the male figure in my life. Mm. So, yeah, it's been an interesting dynamic for sure.
Mm. And Ty, was it a conscious decision for you to take Kyle under your wing, or that just naturally was like the way
I think it's a combination, because like I'm that kind of person with most people in my life. I think from romantic relationships to friendships, like I'm a bit of a carer. But I think with Kyle, obviously helping him in terms of like accepting his gayness and a queer lifestyle and all that sort of stuff, like that was definitely a conscious choice. I felt like I had experience and wisdom to share.
Yeah.
And I felt like I could make accepting himself easier for himself, because that's something I'd already gone through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you took me to my first gay club, like on my 18th birthday and stuff like that. Like, when I look back now, I had like such weird views on homosexuality, and I had so much like internalized homophobia at the time. And I remember like I was like, oh, I'm never going to be like a femme gay, that's disgusting. Like, I had these awful thoughts, and I'm like, I should like really be mask, or like I can't look too gay.
You say to him, you're so gay, you go
yeah,
and I do it on purpose, and you're so gay.
Yeah, mom used to rile me up and be like, you're so gay. But like, and I used to take such offense to it. And yeah, and I think he's definitely helped me become who I am today.
I think I never hated the gay part of myself. Like, that was always a plus. You know, I was like, it's part of what makes me me. And I mean, I haven't always loved myself, but that's never been a reason why. And to see Kyle struggling so much with it, like, that was a big thing to me, because I was like, it's something to be celebrated. It's something to be enjoyed. And I wanted to show him that. And I think, like, one of my favorite things is literally the growth I've seen just since starting this podcast.
Oh, amazing.
The acceptance of himself and his community, and the comfort that he's reached. Like, it's been a huge personal learning tool. So, like, that makes me really proud.
It is. I've seen a huge change.
Mm.
I mean, he's just become more and more of a man.
Thanks, you guys. I'm fine.
Aww.
Oh, God. I'm fine. Yeah, it's a twig or a branch in my eye or something.
Your eyes are red.
Yeah.
Look, I think when queer people hear of people that have siblings that are queer, there's so many questions they have, because it's such a, as I've said, it's such a unique way of growing up. There are experiences that my family will never understand because they have not gone through them themselves, but you two have that to share with each other. Having said that, you also live together. Now, there are a lot of things that my housemates know about me. A lot of
intimate.
You know, they might hear a little sound that comes from my phone every now and then. You know, that my family wouldn't know, regardless of how close I am to them. What is it like living with a gay brother?
Oh, God, it is a gay old time. No, honestly, it's so nice, because we do share all of our friends and we have such a big social group. So it's so nice kind of having like our gay social hub.
Yeah.
And we do like host a lot of drinks and social events. So it's really nice to have that kind of support. And we get like really excited about like hosting things and making cheese boards and like doing all that sort of thing. So it's always been
themed drinks.
Yeah, I guess it's always been... I've never felt uncomfortable about being gay in my own home. And so that's a really nice feeling.
Yeah.
I think he's asking about sex stuff.
Well, there's also that element.
Look,
as well.
I try to block that out.
Is there earmuffs, and that's not just a gay thing. I think any adult siblings living together, like, is it awkward having Grindr roots around?
Well, I think it's also just that Kyle is far more prudish than I am, or he has been. He's much better than he used to be. You couldn't even say, like, sex, sex without his cheeks turning red.
Whatever.
I mean, we'd watch, like, programs on TV. If there was a sex scene, he'd, like...
That's normal. No one wants to watch a sex scene with their parent.
You'd, like, walk after or do something.
Yeah, I mean, even, like, earlier, like... We used to just not talk about sex, or to be like, oh, yeah, that guy.
Mm.
Like, that would be the extent of it. Like, I'm not saying we have in-depth conversations, but like, we're far more comfortable.
Yeah. It would be okay for you then to bring someone home from Poofed or
whatever. Oh, he does. And then,
But you wouldn't be limiting yourself if you knew
Kyle was going
to be home. Because he's lived with me for long enough to know that that's...
To know that I can send an angry text. Or be like, do you mind closing your door?
Toss all his clothes.
I'm interested, you said before that you're really proud of, and this is for both of you really, proud of how Kyle's developed on the podcast by listening to him on the podcast. I imagine for you, Patrizia, it would have been quite lovely to have a weekly sort of update of your son's life when you're living overseas.
Yeah. I mean, I actually enjoy the podcast on a whole.
Thank you.
I know. Yeah, I always wonderful. Think, I'm like, surely you're you great. Can't be enjoying this content. Like, none of it applies to you.
Oh, come on, Carl. But... I mean, I'm an old bag. I used to go to gay clubs and, you know, I've had a life. Thank you.
Yeah. But has it been weird, though, hearing Kyle share the queer parts of his life on the podcast?
I have giggles because I know how prudish he is. So it's just like being wonderful. Yeah.
And like, mum's probably learning stories that she wasn't aware of, whereas for me it was probably just actually to see that interaction and like see the growth and like how he deals with the, you know, the three of you.
Yeah, there were a few times I had a few little tears, you know, especially because being so far away of course, or whatever. But
when he says nice things about me, like I enjoy that because Kyle does not say nice things to my face ever.
Well, what's the point of that?
Listen, thanks both of you so much for coming in today. This has been absolutely beautiful to hear you both talking about Kyle.
It's been eye-opening.
Yeah,
I just can't make Kyle cry. So
no, confirmed. I did not.
There were tears.
There were no tears.
I saw tears.
No.
Now both of you are going to stick around for the after show, of course, because we are going to put you to the test. I'm going to play a bit of a game.
God. Oh, we're going to play a little game, Mum.
We're going to find out who the favourite son is.
Yeah, finally.
Very
finally.
Excited. So for anyone that wants to to listen to that, sign up to our Patreon at patreon.com/gaysrevoltingpod.
Yeah.
And we'll really just try and tear this family apart.
Oh, God.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The Black Aboriginal Corporation was established as a response to the need for visibility for the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander LGBTQ+ community. Black is a not-for-profit, volunteer and community-led initiative, and tonight we're joined by the founder and CEO, William Chulin. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us this week, Will, or virtually. Coming.
Thanks for having me. So I just want to acknowledge country. I live on the lands of the Gadigal people here in Sydney. Acknowledge my ancestors, elders past and present, and acknowledge all of the warriors who have come before me and created space for me to be able to sit and have a yarn with you fabulous boys today. I also want to acknowledge that I am on the shoulders of some pretty staunch and amazing LGBTQ advocates who also have given me a platform to share my experiences, but to also continue carrying the torch for fighting for equal opportunities for not just my Aboriginal community, but my queer Aboriginal community, which I know some of them are the most disadvantaged. And I just want to acknowledge that you boys have allowed us to come on today, and thank you for having Black come and present and be able to share a bit about our story. And it's really important that we always get space to talk about these issues. So I just want to thank you for allowing me to come along and have this yarn with you guys today.
Oh, William, we're so thrilled to have you. Thank you so much for that beautiful welcome. That was lovely.
Yeah.
Now, firstly, what sort of services and resources does Black use to empower the often overlooked members of our First Nations LGBTQ plus community?
Yeah, so it was mentioned that Black was established as a collective response to the need of self-determined and self-led services. And what essentially we're looking at doing is creating space that's done by mob for mob. So a whole raft of initiatives which we're looking at producing over the next kind of 6 months in regards to food services, legal advice, crisis housing, but also around sexual health and how do we support community in getting proper sexual health advice. So there's lots of organisations doing some really amazing work out there, such as ACON in New South Wales, but also understanding that culturally safe spaces are really important as well.
Mm.
So it's understanding is about how do we actually meet the need of what community is saying. So what tends to happen really is a lot of times is that service providers provide services based on funding constraints, and sometimes it doesn't meet our community's needs. So what we're looking at doing is working with those service providers to ensure that they take a holistic approach. But also we're looking at how do we kind of create evidence-based research, which is something that's lacking kind of in particularly in the LGBTQ plus First Nations or Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander space as well, which is hugely important because it helps organisations have a better approach to service provision. But essentially, Black was kind of set up as a collective to say, hey, listen, we need to get together, start creating social change because we've got some of the most kind of vulnerable community members out there. With young homeless people is a risk, is a huge kind of thing we're dealing with. Kids who are leaving home due to them coming out, them coming to Sydney, and there's no kind of touch point. So we're like, well, what are we doing? We need to get better at it. And that's kind of where Black started. And what we're seeing is we're evolving. But at the core of what we're doing is we're placing our mob at the center and figuring out, well, how do we support them to get the best outcome so they can live their best life, essentially.
You raise a really good point with the research that there's not enough research that's been done historically, and we'll get into that a bit more later. But I'm really keen to hear how you connect with community. You know, it's such a vast space, this country. How do you go out and get this information from people to sort of find out what they need?
Yeah, so it's a really good question because it's contextualizing with Aboriginal culture, we're really diverse as a community. One community may be very different from, say, you know, from Dubbo to Sydney, down to South Coast, up to Queensland.
Mm.
So understanding community need is really place-based. So what we're doing is we're looking to connect to build capacity within communities to start talking about and having conversations on issues that impact them so we can look at place-based design. But when we talk about how do we access, we obviously have to use platforms like social media and then coming onto spaces like this space as well, talking about it, it's providing opportunities for us to promote our services, but to connect with people who may not necessarily know that Black's available or Black's around.
Mm.
So it's really about, you know, place-based design or place-based service provision so they get the maximum outcome based on that community need.
Mm.
For our listeners, I think we always like getting people in to share a little bit of insight that they may not have in their day-to-day lives. Could you tell us a little bit about how Indigenous culture approached sexuality pre-colonization and how queer people were included in family structures? You know, I think that's a really fascinating sort of thing to delve into a little.
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting question. And it's something that we're asking ourselves, but we're probably the most under-researched population.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at the experiences of other First Nations communities around the world. So, for example, the Native American people, and there's so much research and credits, concepts like Two Spirits. I'm not sure if you've heard about that, but Two Spirits around the idea of someone having a third gender pre-colonization in the American context or the first Native American context. The issue we face here in Australia is there's actually no research that talks about it. There's no kind of research that articulates LGBTQ experiences pre-colonization or captures that. Not to say it doesn't exist, because it would be highly unlikely that would be the case. I just think due to the fact that we haven't had organisations like Black in the past to be leading the charge or be advocating on behalf of research to be done in that space, it seems to be a bit of a gap. And that's what we're looking at doing. So we're heavily involved in research as an organisation and partnering with places like University of Western Sydney. And we're looking at social emotional well-being of young LGBTQ people and the intersectionality of culture and identity and their experiences. But as a part of that, that is about growing evidence base, like I talked about previously, because of the lack of data. But it's about giving us, I guess, a platform to start having much larger conversations around the concept of sexuality or the intersectionality of culture and sexual identity prior to colonization.
Hmm.
I think what we're also discussing is around, well, how do we want to define ourselves as queer people or as queer Aboriginal people? Because the LGBTQ plus is a very westernized term. There is now conversation about actually well, is there a way that we want to redefine ourselves as queer Blackfellas or queer Torres Strait Islander people? And what does that actually look like? So it's a really exciting time in that space. So
fascinating.
I would say watch it because we are actively kind of seeking more clarity around it.
I was going to say, I also think it's really important and amazing that it is Indigenous people that are doing this research because as we've now learned, and we're only finding out now, I mean, I went to a white suburban school and I'm only discovering now how white very little teaching of Indigenous history was so whitewashed because it was research that was done white people and then sort of changed for white textbooks. It's so amazing that it is Indigenous people that are doing this Indigenous research that will then be presenting that information because that's actually going to be what helps in the future, I think.
Yeah, and we're looking at talking about, well, actually, well, how do we create an ethical platform so when they're conducting this research, it's done on our terms? And what does that mean when we mean by our terms? How does the data then get used and what does data sovereignty look like? And these are very much narratives and conversations that are happening and Black's leading the way. Like we're very actively having lots of conversations with universities and other peak organisations to start challenging the status quo. What tends to get missed within our community is around the importance of queer people within kinship and how that actually kind of what our roles are. So from my experience and from the people who are within my network, what I find tends to happen is people who identify as a part of our community tend to be the ones that obviously have a leadership role within the family as well. We don't. There's no research to back to why that is, but what we're seeing is I think because we've had to deal with the idea of culture and sexuality and that colliding and how we manage it, there is this sense of capability within our queer community that we tend to take on a more kind of leadership role within our family dynamic and or actually the workplace as well. So as you see, you've obviously met Alan Clark last week, who's just an extremely amazing human, but there are some really incredible Aboriginal LGBTQ activists and people who have been working in this space for a lot longer than I have that have also been a part of family structure that have kept families alive as well. So it begs to differ. If we actually did the research, we'd probably find the similar kind of narrative pre-colonization as well.
So I'm really keen to know, so obviously there is a huge amount of research to be done still and you've only really just started, but what does some of this new data show us about Indigenous people, how they're experiencing their queerness? I'm especially interested in like younger people. Do we know yet, are younger Indigenous people more comfortable to be coming out now compared to say 10 or 15 years ago?
Yeah, so there is lots of data as it relates to the LGBTQ experience as a collective. The issue with that data is it doesn't actually necessarily reflect the diversity within that. So obviously the cold community, so the diverse community from people from non-English speaking backgrounds, but also Aboriginal communities aren't necessarily reflected in all of its true essence because of their questions aren't getting asked effectively. So there's lots of work happening around the data sets. But what we're seeing with some of the data, you know, we look at the Gowena survey, which is a survey done by a South Australian man. I can't remember his name for the life of me, but it's about surveying young people around whole raft of questions, but some of the early data released in 2018 talks about the lack of sexual education within young queer people, particularly around HIV awareness and prevention. So there are alarming kind of trends that are happening with, you know, a 33% increase of HIV transmission within Aboriginal men, particularly over the kind of last 2 years, which is a huge kind of concern. So what that kind of tells us, or what we're seeing with that, is that we know that the campaigns that are being done aren't necessarily reaching our community, hence why Black's really important to start challenging the system, because what the data is showing is there is a decrease within non-Aboriginal people, within, I guess, the white men, essentially, but what we're seeing is there's a much more increase within within the Aboriginal kind of communities. So there's a lots of work to do, and I think the data now, hopefully over the next kind of 2 years when we start advocating and activating partnerships like ACON and start challenging how they capture data, we'll hopefully have a much more clearer picture.
Now, you mentioned before, last week we spoke with Alan Clark about Australia's awful record of Indigenous deaths in custody, but incarceration rates are also incredibly disproportionate. Indigenous people are locked up for small drug possessions and things like unpaid fines, while white people often walk away with nothing but, you know, a warning and a slap on the wrist. Do you think this is plain racism? Like, is it conscious racism or is it more of an unconscious bias? And I guess then the next question is, which one is harder to fight?
Oh, right. Okay, so this has about 40 layers to the question. But look, no, it's a really important question to unpack, though. I really think it's something to understand because it's highly complex. And the issue of the incarceration rates that we see now of First Nations people and, you know, and of young people in the juvenile justice system, you know, if you look at the Northern Territory experience, I think it's like 97% of young people in the juvenile justice system in Northern Territory are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. Like, that's just mind-boggling, you know. You know, we are the highest incarcerated people in the world. It's now known fact. And the interesting thing is when we start talking about this, the narrative that comes from non-Aboriginal people and starts, what they do is they try and defend by giving alternative data by saying that, well, they have this many white people being killed or, you know. But I think the issue that we face or the issue when we start doing that becomes dangerous and misses, I think, starts kind of diluting the importance of understanding why people are incarcerated,
yes,
and how the system lets them down. Now, I want to make it very clear to everybody, like, I'm not saying that all Aboriginal people who are in jail don't need to be there. It's not what I'm saying. There are absolutely experiences that need to be acknowledged of people who have been hurt by criminals. The difference is around the system is set up to discriminate. Now, if you think about culturally, we have an Aboriginal culture, pre-colonization, that got an imposed system from a Western world. Mm-hmm. So they have this kind of Western ideology brought in. They created policies and legislations that did not meet with us culturally. The other part is also around power of definition. So we're operating in a space, particularly as Aboriginal people, where we don't have the power of defining what that language means.
Mm.
So you look at this idea of the word neglect, and in a Western terms, it means that you aren't looking after your child, or you aren't looking after yourself, based on this kind of idea of what neglect means on a Western term. What we're saying, or what we're seeing now, is this term necessarily doesn't bend or allow itself in the Aboriginal context. So I might have my family members over who have kids. Those four kids might sleep on a mattress in the lounge room. Based on a Western term, that could be deemed as neglect. I then can get myself in trouble. So the reason why it's important and the reason why we talk about this is when we need to understand then, well, why is it that Aboriginal people then are being locked up? And you look at 10-year day experience, and I'm going to use these names very, very purposefully. 10-year day was discriminated against based on her color. In the coroner's request, on the coroner's inquest, they talked about another person who was also drunk on the following train. Police were called. They took that person home. So we talk about how institutional discrimination works and what does that actually mean. So if you then take into consideration power of definition, you take into consideration how those laws are then interpreted and how those laws are then applied to people of color, and then we start seeing the disproportionate of kind of, well, actually, this is how or why Aboriginal people are particularly being incarcerated at a higher rate than non-Aboriginal people. And you only have to look at some of the laws. Like, I'm assuming you boys have been drunk in public before, because I know I have.
Me? Yes.
Yeah, right? But did you know that up until recently, you could be locked up for being drunk in public in Victoria?
But just for being drunk?
Just for being drunk in public. And that's the premise of what 10-year day was locked up on, being drunk in public. And that's the law they use to lock her up. They then said it was actually because they were afraid for her safety, but yet not once they didn't check on her in six hours. When I go watch the Melbourne Cup and see all these people leaving the Melbourne Cup, it's very rarely you see people getting locked up for being drunk, right? But it happened to Tanya, and Tanya got locked up and she died because of the injuries that she received. So these are really, really prime examples or clear examples of how a outdated policy which was based on Western terms discriminate against someone of colour and how they can be used to discriminate on someone against the colour. And that's up to the authority's discretion to use it. So, you know, I think the small drug possessions and the unpaid fines, and, you know, you look at WA, you can be locked up for having unpaid fines. Now, I have unpaid fines in my name in New South Wales, and I'm very fortunate that I can't be locked up. But it's just really interesting when you kind of see it happen and play out. And whether they're unconscious bias or not, I don't know. It's really hard to unpack because, once again, there's no research to talk about it. The research that was done in 1991 at the Royal Commission that had 300-plus recommendations, and four out of 300 were implemented. And the interesting thing about that is one of the recommendations was they need to abolish the law of being drunk in public in 1991. So if they thought about that, you think about that. If they did that, tenure wouldn't be dead.
Mm.
Yeah.
I need to change my words. I said there, is it, you know, plain racism or is it unconscious bias? Unconscious bias is still racism, and it really, I should have said unconscious racism, which doesn't make it any better ethically, but it just is, it's, I guess, a different way of.
Yeah, and look, and I teach this as a part of my job, so I wear multiple hats, and one of my roles is about building capabilities of people to understand the Aboriginal experience. The interesting thing about the topic of unconscious bias, it requires, first off, for me, it requires an Australia to acknowledge, and what I mean by that is the context of Australia's history. You mentioned previously about, you know, it gets whitewashed at school. But Australia's history only starts 250 years ago, which I find really interesting when Aboriginal history goes back 60,000 years, which we don't embrace, which I think we're really doing ourselves injustice, because I would be super proud. Well, I am super proud that we live on a country that housed the oldest living civilization in this world. Mm. And it's such a rich and beautiful and unique culture that has some of the most unique principles backing it. But we only talk about only 250 years of history. Do you know what I mean? So, like, yeah. I think, you know, we do ourselves an injustice by not embracing that.
It's quite shocking to people from other cultures when they figure that out, when they visit Australia or they spend some time here, if they see how disconnected a lot of the people are from our history beyond those 250 years, it's kind of shocking to them, because we get taught that this country started,
250 years ago, but it didn't. Like, you know, this, we've got the evidence, and this is not blackfellow evidence. This is Western academia evidence that talks, scientific evidence that proves what we're saying. So we're only going by what the research is showing as in regards to our history. But the interesting thing is when we talk about Australian culture, people tend to go, I'll put a shrimp on the barbie or something. And I'm like, well, shrimp's bloody American for starters, right? And like, you think about, it's like Lemingtons or Pavlovas, both also adopted from New Zealand. And, you know, Russell Crowe also adopted from New Zealand. So this kind of idea of a cultural, we have a bit of an identity crisis, I think, as a society. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that we only talk about 250 years of history, but the reality is we've got tens of thousands of years of history, which is incredibly beautiful and, you know, and diverse and intricate and unique, that we should be celebrating. Because that's the problem, is that if we start talking about the issues, we'll have to start having to look inwards. And I think to your point there, people are scared of that. And, you know, we see it all the time. You talk about privilege, or you talk about white privilege or male privilege, and most of the time people seize up and they hold their breath and they get really tense. So what I mean, I'm going to say statements, probably going to sound a little weird, but I'm super privilege positive, which means that we should talk about our privileges, and let's get comfortable with being uncomfortable to talk about them. Because when we don't, that's when they're dangerous. And that's what I find happens with all that narrative. When you see it on Twitter, is that they get too uncomfortable. Let's not talk about it. Let's just kind of lay blame. So it kind of justifies the means to the end. And I'm just like, I just get so tired of that kind of.
It's tiring. Yeah. It's so tiring. But it is, I think it's like a defense mechanism that means I don't have to pull apart this system that actually has benefited me in a lot of ways for my life.
The thing, isn't it? It's been confronted by the fact that you have benefited from this bias, and so if you're going to look at it, you've then got to acknowledge that you shouldn't have been receiving, you know.
Easier for me to go, it's this person's fault, they should have, this would have happened to them anyway. But similar on that note, a very strong message coming out of the US right now is this call to defund the police, to take money out of the police force, put it into things like education. That's in response to the Black Lives Matter movement and the protests that are happening right now. With the issues that we're facing here in Australia, we're looking at that same concept and saying, what does this concept mean for us here in Australia? And what would that mean for the Indigenous people of Australia if we were to similarly throw up our arms and say, let's cut funding, let's defund the police here? What does that look like for our Indigenous people?
Yeah, and look, and I'm gonna speak from my experience and what that means to me, and that's got to do with the experience through my work and within my community and within my network. And I think the idea of defunding police, I actually want to go one further. I think we need to look at defunding the system that keeps people impoverished. So 2016, there was a Productivity Commission report, which was went into a whole raft of areas. But the one that kind of really stood out to us as a community was the spend within Aboriginal affairs across the country, both federally, state and locally. And I think off the top of my head, the Productivity Commission report stated that Aboriginal or First Nations or Indigenous spend across the country was about $31 billion. Now, I just want to let that sink in. That's $31 billion. The interesting thing that, which also the product, the report kind of articulated, was actually how much they interface with community. And what it says, I think it's about $5.9 billion. So we have a national spend, about $31 billion in Aboriginal affairs across the country, or Indigenous affairs, or whatever you want to call it. And 5.9 of that interface with community. So that's money going into organizations to provide services and or build programs, so forth and so on. So that tells us that there's about $24 billion being spent back of house.
Yeah.
You think about the incarceration rate. If we were to remove those kids, so I think it, you know, I think it's like $100,000 to keep someone in prison each year on a taxpayer's dime. Don't quote me on it. You can fact check me later. Yeah. I know it's a lot of money to keep people in prison, right? It's costing a fortune to do it. So like I look at what these statistics show us, and the idea of defunding I think is a really interesting concept that we need to start looking at. Well, how are we spending? Why are we being reactive to what the issues are? Why aren't we looking at proactive approaches to break the cycle, which doesn't happen? I see it every day that, oh, we've got a kid being removed. Well, let's keep them in the out-of-home care system. Let's not work with the mum, but then let's kind of, you know, let's perpetuate the problem by disconnecting that young person from family, disconnecting that young person from culture, and then we create the next generation of stolen kids, right?
Yes.
But it's like, well, actually, let's challenge the system. Why are we being reactive to these issues? Let's start being proactive and start engaging on grassroots place-based design to create solutions by community for community. And if we start doing it within Black communities, I guarantee it can be adopted across all communities.
Yeah, it does feel like we've just been putting patches on a system that was broken in the first place. It's just had patches slapped on it every couple of decades. And what we really need to do is be tearing down this entire thing and starting from scratch and looking at what people actually need and what's actually going to help.
Because I'll say to you, I guarantee if they looked at reinvesting that $31 billion and actually gave it to communities that understood the community and the community sentiment, we wouldn't be in this position. There are I look at some of the wages that get spent in government departments. We have people earning $300,000 a year that makes decisions that go against all Aboriginal people. Like, well, could you imagine giving $300,000 to a local community organization?
Yeah.
Or money, you know, $300,000 to an organization like Black.
To give that to Black, exactly.
Exactly. That would go a long way. We could probably run programs for 3 to 4 years that we were able to provide job outcomes, training, engagement, and building community capabilities at a grassroots level. But it's like, well, we're too busy paying senior executives sitting in government departments $300,000+ that I'm like, well, you know, so that's where when you start looking at that, understanding what that $31 billion gets spent on, I get frustrated, not just as an Aboriginal person, but as a taxpayer. And I'm like, well, why are more people not mad about this?
People should be mad.
Right?
Now, on a bit more of a lighter note before we let you go, you lead 3 Black businesses in Australia, and there's a real push for allies like myself to start putting our money where our mouth is and donate money or spend money in these communities. What's the best way for listeners to show their support for Indigenous-led businesses?
Yeah, so well, obviously, Black Aboriginal Corporation, volunteer-based organisation. We get no funding. We hustle to make our ends meet to provide services for communities. So you can donate. So donate to organisations like Black, and if you go to www.blaq.org.au, you'll find links there. And just in regards to Indigenous businesses, you know, I know there's some amazing, capable Black fellas out there that are kicking goals, from artists to musicians to policymakers to community engagers, participating economically to create social change for their community. I'm one of these people. I run multiple businesses, which gives me the ability to volunteer my skills as a CEO of Black to produce outcomes for my community. So, you know, if you're engaging an artist, look at purchasing not just the artwork, but purchasing a license around how you can use it around, well, what is it that you can do to be creative and innovative, to not just say, well, here's a piece of art, let's just buy it for the sake of buying it. Well, let's start using it. How do you license it? And if you're going to be engaging, there are lots and lots of capable Aboriginal businesses out there. And I would just encourage you, educate yourself about who's out there. And there's organizations like Supply Nation, which has a database of businesses who can provide services across the board. And what I would also say, if wherever you're listening, in, you know, around the world, because I know this is worldwide, talk about, like, find out the organizations in your local community, place-based support. How can you support those guys? What are some of the non-for-profits or the guys who are doing the hard works on the ground, and how you can support them? And sometimes it's not monetary. Just remember that. But it's not just about money. It's about volunteering, immersing yourself in the, immersing yourself in the experience of the First Nations people, Aboriginal people, and go give your skills, provide opportunities for them to learn off you and you to learn off them. And for me, that's for me is about how we start building that gap also, is around, well, embracing Aboriginal culture, because my culture as an Aboriginal man is your culture as well. I mean, is everyone culture in Australia, because it's not just a 250-year history, it's a shared history of Aboriginal culture that we all should be really proud of.
Yeah. Honestly, thank you so much for chatting with us. And
this has been fantastic.
Please do come and visit us in Melbourne.
Yeah. No worries. And when we have our launch, we'll get an invite to you boys to hopefully come to Sydney and celebrate.
Oh, please. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we're meant to do it in April, but obviously COVID hit, so we've pushed it back. But we're all having a celebrative party as a formal.
I love an excuse to pop up to Sydney. So, yes, please.
Yeah, we went wild. We went to Sydney for Mardi Gras, which seems like a whole nother world ago. But that was so much fun. We would definitely, please send us an invite. And thank you again for sharing your knowledge, your time, your voice with our show. We love it, and we're so grateful for the work that you do.
Thanks, William.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
What a big episode. Two very big, very different, but wonderful interviews.
It's been such a long time coming. And very special episode to me, obviously. And thank you, everyone, for being a part of it. Thank you for subscribing to our Patreon. Stay tuned. We are going to play a very fun game. But with my family. we'll see if it's fun. But okay. But until next week.
Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.